sperm donation is big business.
It's a global market. Patients travel, but sperm is also shipped abroad.
A new investigation reveals that nearly 200 children were born from one donor who had a cancer-causing genetic mutation.
This is really not a mutation you want your child to have.
Today on The World, the investigation into donor 7069.
Also, mass deportations in the U.S. have meant young kids are going to immigration court by themselves.
Frankly, I don't believe that they understand the gravity of the situation because, I mean, they're just learning about what a judge is.
How the legal aid system is trying to help, plus fonts.
It's old. I'm picturing, you know, Gutenberg, like, printing his Bibles.
Typeface gets political. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. That's all ahead today on The World.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. We're glad you're here with us today. A story that's riveting Europe right now is about one man who donated sperm in Denmark that ended up being sold in at least 14 countries and was used to conceive nearly 200 babies, maybe even more.
Donor 7069, it turns out, carried a genetic mutation that increases the risk of cancer. Some of the children conceived with the man's sperm have already died. Others are expected to develop cancer. That's according to a new investigation by 14 European public service broadcasters. Naomi Conrad worked on this story with our partners at Deutsche Welle. She says the genetic mutation has serious implications.
It basically messes with a gene that's called TP53 that suppresses cancerous growth. So if this gene doesn't work properly, if there's a mutation, it basically means that from a very early age onwards, you can develop cancers. And children or young adults who have this mutation develop cancer at a very early age, but it's a lifelong risk. So they develop 2, 3, 4 different kinds of cancer. So it's very serious. It's also very important that parents know if their children carry this mutation because they need to undergo lifelong screenings. Mm. You have to be very careful with radiation, so no x-rays. So in this case, time is of the essence, really.
Yeah. So for some genes, you can say, you know, you have a 50% risk of getting breast cancer or something like that. Is there a percentage that you can give us that helps us understand this one?
The risk is very, very high. It may be as high as 90% of developing loads of different kinds of cancer. So this is really not a mutation you want your child to have.
And are sperm banks supposed to screen for this mutation?
No, they don't. That's the thing. So the normal screening process includes the more usual things like HIV screenings. But because this is such a rare mutation, it's not part of the usual screening process. The donor was healthy. He hasn't developed, as far as we know. He definitely hadn't at the time when he donated some 17 years ago. He hadn't developed any kind of cancer. So there was no indication whatsoever, as far as we know, that he was a carrier of this rare mutation. And that's why he wasn't screened for it. And on top of that, at the time, they didn't even have the tools to screen for it.
Right. So how was it discovered that all of these children conceived with his sperm had this genetic mutation?
One donor-conceived child got sick around 2020, or at least that's when it was reported back to the sperm bank. They tested his sperm. But to make things even more complicated, this mutation only appears in a certain percentage. We're not even entirely sure what percentage of his sperm. That means they tested it. It came back negative. Mm. Another child got sick. They retested more samples in 2023. So 3 years later, realized that some of the tests came back positive, and then they immediately took him off the market and started informing the fertility clinics that had offered these procedures.
Your investigation has accounted for nearly 200 kids conceived using this donor sperm. Is it typical for one donor sperm to be used that much?
Well, that's the big question, and that's what the sperm bank doesn't really want to tell us, but it doesn't seem that unusual. Only a very small percentage of prospective donors actually make the cut. So they test these donors, only about 5 to 8%. Their sperm basically passes muster. They need to survive being frozen. So there's a lot of investment that goes into finding donors that are viable. And the other thing is that there are no European, let alone global, caps on how many children can be conceived with one donor sperm. That's what a lot of doctors, advocates, parents, and also donor conceived children are calling for, that there's a European, or maybe even ideally an international cap, and also a registry, because what you need is a registry where you store the DNA of each donor so you can make sure that one donor who's gone to one sperm bank hasn't in fact also gone to another sperm mm-hmm. bank in the same country or in another country.
So what has happened to these donor-conceived children so far? I did mention that some at least have already died.
We don't know how many have died. We know that at least 25 carry the mutation out of 77 that doctors told us had been tested as of May of this year.
And how are the families that are going through this coping with all of this? It obviously would be a huge shock and scary.
Of course. I mean, we talked to one mother who said it felt a bit like she was entering a tunnel and that her parenthood had been stolen by this. I mean, of course, a lot of parents are incredibly worried. Some parents are lucky because their children don't carry the mutation. It's a little bit like Russian roulette, I guess, at this point, whether or not your child carries the mutation.
What kind of reforms are now being suggested to try to prevent this from happening again?
Well, the European Union has come out with new regulations, which are set to come into place in 2027, but they don't actually at this point include a European-wide cap. So there's still not going to be at the European level any kind of upper limit of how many children are conceived from one donor sperm. There's going to be a little better coordination, more information exchange at the European level come 2027. The European Sperm Bank itself has said that it's now instigated a rule of 75 children per donor. But that's not a law. I mean, that's a self-imposed rule, right? So whether or not they actually abide by it, you need some kind of oversight, which was clearly lacking.
Hmm. Of course, sperm donation happens all over the world. Is the issue of transnational sperm donation riddled with these problems all over the place, would you expect?
Oh, absolutely. And there's a lot of fertility tourism. We know that some families from the US are traveling to Europe because fertility treatment in some countries is a lot cheaper than the US. A lot of families, for example, from Germany, where egg donations are illegal, travel to Spain. So it's a patchwork of rules and regulations, and what's allowed in one country may not be allowed in another. So it's a global market. Sperm is also shipped abroad. We know that the UK imports a lot of its sperm because they don't have enough donations in the UK. And so it would really need global international rules and regulations to deal with this problem.
Naomi Conrad is a reporter with our partners Deutsche Welle, DW in Germany. This investigation was a collaboration by 14 public service broadcasters in Europe.
India produces more mangoes than any other country in the world. Mangoes are so important for India that they're known there as the king of fruits. But global conflicts and climate change have upended the market, and that has farmers in southern India scrambling for solutions. Namrata Kolachlam brought us this report from the state of Andhra Pradesh.
I'm standing in an orchard near the so-called mango city of Chittoor. Over the last few decades, this semi-arid region has thrived on a growing market for exporting mangoes. While many Indians still prefer fresh mangoes from the market, demand for processed products like pulp has soared in Europe, the Middle East, and the U.S. So thousands of farms in the district supply mangoes to dozens of manufacturing plants in Chittoor that produce the fresh pulp for ice creams, jams, and juices. I tour one of these sprawling campuses with the owner, Anil Kumar, who shows me how it works. First, he purchases mangoes from farmers and places them into ripening chambers for 5 days. From there,
they go in these belt conveyors to fruit washings.
They're washed, crushed, sterilized, canned, and ready to ship.
We manufacture regularly 100 to 150 containers per season, 20 tons per container.
That's a lot of mangoes. When we enter the warehouse, he shows me hundreds of cans of mango pulp made from this season's harvest. But some of these cans have been sitting here for 2 years. That's because conflict in Ukraine and Gaza have scrambled shipping routes. Now, Kumar's trying to offload his mango pulp in India. But the price he can get for mango products in India is a fraction of what he could get in places like the United Arab Emirates, one of his traditional markets.
All the containers have to pass from the Red Sea only, because 90% of the mango pulp is exported to Middle East.
Instead of reaching the UAE, these tins have gathered dust since 2023. It's a secondary impact of global conflict. These disruptions have hit farmers hard as well. Many of them grow a hardy variety of mango called Totopuri. But this year, there was an oversupply, so the price of Totopuris crashed. Farmers who couldn't sell their fruits left them rotting in the fields. But it's not just market factors putting stress on growers. Farmers have also been contending with climate change. In the past 5 years or so, the seasonal, steady rains in Chittor have transformed into a series of unpredictable cloudbursts. One farmer, Kamatham Vishwanath Mudalir, explains what this means. When it rains and the mangoes take on too much water, the viscosity changes and the mangoes are damaged, he says. Customers trying these mangoes will find them mushy and unappealing. Shifts in the mango season cause other problems. Usually, hot days and cooler nights in late fall trigger mango trees to start flowering. But there are fewer cool nights now, so some trees are flowering in February instead of December. All of these changes wreak havoc on India's favorite fruit.
Now, over a period of time, due to change in the weather, 3 or 4 new pests have entered into the mango ecosystem.
That's Srinivasa Reddy, a senior scientist working on mangoes near Chittor. He says insects that never lived in Andhra Pradesh are attacking the fruit. To protect their livelihoods, farmers are spraying more pesticides than before.
Now the average number of sprays for the Chittor farmers was 4 to 5. What was a decade back? Only 2 sprays.
Farmers say they have no choice but to use these chemicals. But for customers, more pesticides can mean less taste. On a festival day, with a giant speaker blaring nearby, a local doctor named Pradeep expressed real sadness about how the taste of mango has changed since he was a kid.
When we are kids, that taste is not coming. Our children will not get that taste, I think.
This year, government officials gave farmers small fruit covers to shield each mango from rain and bugs. Officials also gave mango farmers a subsidy, but it was small, less than 1 cent for every 2 pounds of fruit. All of these issues have led Govardhan Babi, who's a chair of the All India Food Processors, to brainstorm solutions to grow the domestic market for mango products, like a new marketing campaign for mango juice.
We started one logo, Sip Mango, Skip Doctor. Because if you see people abroad using an apple a day, keep doctors away.
In case you missed it, his slogan is Sip Mango, Skip Doctor, a spin on the American saying, an apple a day keeps the doctor away. He also hopes that the government will form an official board to set a consistent price for mangoes to keep the market fair for the farmers. And while climate change is an issue, Bobby prefers to keep the focus on what people can control.
We will not worry about the weather. We are worrying about the war.
With all this upheaval, some local experts have suggested that farmers stop growing Totopuri mangoes, or mangoes altogether. But in Chittor, farmers rely on these fruits to survive. And manufacturers like Anil Kumar depend on them for their pulp. He plans to keep working without speculating on the future.
If we say this season will be good, it will be very bad. If we say this will be very bad season, it will be good.
Instead of making predictions, he says he'll keep a close eye on the mango trees, which are set to start blooming in just a few weeks. Hopefully, that means a good crop come June. For The World, I'm Namrata Kalachalam, Chittor, India.
You're listening to The World.
The
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. China says it's putting new controls on some of the chemicals used to make fentanyl. That's the drug linked to most overdose deaths in the U.S. From now on, Chinese companies will need special licenses to ship those chemicals to North America, the U.S., Canada, and Mexico. The move is part of a recent agreement between the U.S. and China. Most of the illegal fentanyl in the U.S. is made in Mexico with ingredients that come from China. The World's Tibi Saizea reports from Mexico City.
The basic fentanyl supply chain looks like this.
We have chemicals coming out of China, going to Mexico, used to manufacture synthetic drugs, being shipped into the United States.
Daniel Baldwin works on U.S.-China cooperation against illicit drugs. He says this supply chain has proven hard to disrupt. Now, China says it's regulating 13 chemical precursors used to make fentanyl. The rule basically adds a checkpoint. If a Chinese company wants to ship one of these chemicals, the government now reviews who the buyer is and why.
So this process, right, because it creates a paper trail within the system, potentially could allow law enforcement, say in Mexico, Canada, or the United States, to be able to track that record back to the original shipper.
But Baldwin says enforcing the rules is still a challenge. China's chemical sector is huge, and shipments often pass through several middlemen, making tracing more difficult. Also, traffickers in Mexico often create fake companies to make themselves look like legitimate buyers. And there is another problem. China is only restricting a small fraction of the chemicals used to make fentanyl. Many other ingredients are still completely legal.
Many precursors of fentanyl are used in legal pharmacology, legal pharmaceutical industry, agriculture, legal chemistry. They're just very basic chemicals.
Vanda Felba-Brown is with the Brookings Institution. She says even if China stopped being a source of fentanyl ingredients, traffickers could look for other countries, like India, where the pharmaceutical sector is loosely regulated. But there is some hope. This is not the first time China has tightened controls. In 2023, the government started restricting some chemical precursors, and the impact showed up quickly in the U.S.
The number of fatal overdoses from fentanyl has declined very substantially over an 18-month period.
That's Peter Reuter, a professor of drug policy and criminology at the University of Maryland. He says 18 months is actually much longer than expected. Drug traffickers usually adapt within a few months to government crackdowns.
What that suggests is that it is not so easy to adapt to this.
Also, during that time, fentanyl on U.S. streets became less potent. Jonathan Calkins, a drug policy researcher at Carnegie Mellon University, says these supply-side shocks won't end the fentanyl trade, but they can still save lives.
So if your standard is we're only interested in something that completely makes the drug supply go away forever, it's not going to do that. But if your standard is, will it save people's lives, maybe even hundreds or thousands of lives, there is hope for that.
He says even modest actions can matter. But in the long run, Calkins says supply controls alone won't solve the crisis.
We will always want law enforcement to prevent the criminal organizations from becoming too powerful, too violent, too damaging to democratic institutions. That's an ongoing, crucial mission.
The bigger challenge, he says, is stopping people from becoming addicted. For the World, I'm Tibi Saizea, Mexico City.
Holiday shopping season in Paris has been a little less sparkle and glitz and a little more protest and outrage this month. That's because the ultra-fast fashion retailer Shein recently opened a brick-and-mortar store inside Paris's historic BHV department store. John Lawrenson with our partners at DW reports on the controversy.
Over the couple of weeks that it's been open, Parisians have been showing that while their city is this, the opening of Shein's first permanent physical retail location in the world, it is also this. Fired up by the shock revelation that sex dolls with the appearance of a young girl holding a teddy bear had been for sale on the Singapore-based site, protesters mingled with queuing shoppers in front of the BHV department store. This one, reacting to allegations of forced labor, child labor, low wages and excessive working hours among Shein's thousands of suppliers, mainly in China but also in India, Brazil and Turkey, said, "I've been a customer of BHV for years. It's shameful. I want people to realize that it's completely abnormal for this brand to settle in Paris physically." But many others formed long lines in the hope of a bargain. Yes, it's controversial, but in that case, all stores are controversial, said this woman. Because when you look closely, so much comes from China. Here, though, when you look at the prices, nothing else in France comes near.
Le gouvernement engage la procédure de suspension de Shein.
In the wake of the sex doll scandal, the Minister for Small Businesses, Serge Papin, told the National Assembly that he'd been instructed by the Prime Minister to start suspension proceedings against Shein while he said the Chinese company was adjusting to French laws. France wants a three-month suspension. Even before the Paris shop opening, the French authorities had taken several actions against the Chinese fast fashion retailer, fining Shein, for example, for nearly 200 million euros for various consumer protection violations. There's now a draft anti-fast fashion law, which, if finally adopted, will impose a surcharge of 5 euros on each item sold to offset the environmental cost.
Nous sommes rentrés en guerre.
As for Paris Deputy Mayor for Sustainability Patrick Bloch, he said that Paris City Hall had declared war on Shein and BHV. It represents ultra-fast fashion, he said, which betrays Paris's values. One measure it's taken is to forbid BHV from hosting outdoor Christmas events. Meanwhile, some of the standard bearers of Paris as a centre for high-quality, highly durable, high fashion also protested against Shein's implantation at BHV by withdrawing from the store. Brands like Chanel and Dior will no longer sell their clothing there, which is bound to affect sales at the department store. But Frédéric Merlin, CEO of SGM, the company that owns BHV, is not concerned. He believes that the increase in traffic thanks to Shein will easily compensate any losses elsewhere.
Je pense qu'il y a un tapage médiatique.
I think there's an irrational media and political outburst around the Shein affair, Merlin said. Shein is 1,000 square metres in a building that is 50,000 square metres. It's a popular success. We welcome between 8,000 and 10,000 people every day who have come specially for Shein. Whatever the outcome of the battle in France, the signs are that it may take a while for the model to spread. Reacting to the backlash, BHV's parent company has announced that the opening of new Shein stores in Dijon, Grenoble, Reims, Limoges and Angers have been put on hold. John Lawrence in Paris.
That story comes from our partners DW and their program Inside Europe. You're listening to The World.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. In Serbia, protests against government corruption and negligence have rocked the country for more than a year. Protests led by students are often held outside of the former headquarters of the Yugoslav army. The building was bombed by NATO forces in 1999. Many Serbs regard the site as a memorial to those who died. But plans are now underway to transform the location into a luxury hotel complex to be known as Trump Tower Belgrade. The World's Europe correspondent Orla Berry has more.
In mid-November, thousands of protesters formed a human chain around the outside of the former Yugoslav army headquarters in Belgrade and painted a bright red line around the site's perimeter. It was a symbol, they said, of their pledge that they would defend the crumbling building at all costs. The plans to demolish the site affects me personally, one young protester in a green hoodie tells local television. My parents survived the NATO bombing. Now the government wants to erase a whole generation with this plan. During the Kosovo War in 1999, US-led NATO forces attacked the army headquarters. trip is part of a much wider assault aimed at stopping Serb forces from attacking Albanian Muslims across the border in Kosovo. The military building was already well known in Belgrade.
It is the masterpiece of modernist architecture in former Yugoslavia by the renowned, not only locally but internationally renowned architect Nikola Dobrovic.
Sneška Kvartflich Mihailovic is the Secretary General of Europa Nostra, an organisation dedicated to protecting cultural and historical sites. She says it came as a surprise to some when news emerged that the Serbian government was planning to lease the site to a US investor. After all, it was US forces that led that NATO attack. Although, as MSNBC pointed out recently, one US real estate developer had expressed interest in building a luxury hotel in Belgrade 12 years ago.
A little over a decade ago, Donald Trump, then just a private businessman, meets with the Prime Minister of Serbia and tells him how much he would like to build a luxury hotel in the Serbian capital of Belgrade.
That deal never happened, but last year a company called Affinity Partners drew up plans to turn the former military compound into a $500 million luxury hotel and apartment complex. The group's founder is Jared Kushner, son-in-law to President Trump. Kushner has said in interviews that he never discussed the Belgrade project with Trump. His company didn't respond to my request for an interview. The army building was granted protected heritage status 20 years ago. And Kvartflich Mihailovic says the Serbian government can't just give it away.
They have offered something that simply any responsible government that is acting in accordance with the constitution and the law of Serbia was simply not in the position to offer.
But in November, Parliament appeared to do just that. The time of ruins is over. It's time for new construction, a new era, Milenko Jovanov, a government MP, said in Parliament after MPs passed a law paving the way for Kushner's hotel complex to go ahead. Opposition lawmakers, architects, historians and students have all protested the decision.
It's not only about defending this building. It's part of a much bigger picture.
This philosophy student at the University of Belgrade tells me the government's plan to sell off the site is a symbol of everything that's wrong with her country. She doesn't want to give her name, she says, for fear of reprisal from the government.
We're basically being faced with our country being in a state, what one professor of law called a constitutional decay.
The Serbian Prime Minister sees it very differently.
Mi imamo prava.
We have the right to use the land, Aleksandar Vučić said on local television this week, and to profit from it. The US company will invest $750 million. That's a huge investment for our country, he said. Opposition lawmakers say the parliament's ruling is unconstitutional and they plan to challenge it in court. Nemanja Nenadic with anti-corruption NGO Transparency Serbia isn't sure that'll come to much.
Part of the problem is the fact that Constitutional Court of Serbia did not react promptly, did not react at all.
Nenadic says even the agreement signed by the government and Kushner's company leaves a lot of unanswered questions, including why the site wasn't opened to other potential investors. Cultural heritage expert Sneška Kvartflich Mihailovic says she has some advice for Jared Kushner and his company.
I would say that they definitely should not want to be part of a scheme that is so blatantly based on the violation of the constitution and the rule of law.
Because that's no way to build relations between the two countries, she says. For the world, I'm Orla Barry.
In northern Nigeria, several parents have spent their first full day reunited with their children. That's after the children had been abducted when gunmen stormed their school in the city of Papiri in late November. Out of more than 300 children who were abducted, 100 were released over the weekend, rejoining their parents late last night.
The Nigerian government didn't share details about the students who had been released. It also hasn't given an update on the condition of the 150 children who have not come home and who remain in captivity. So far, no one has claimed responsibility for the abductions.
The FIFA World Cup has been lighting up a lot of group chats over the past week now that the matches are drawn and the schedule is set. One match in particular is causing controversy, though, Egypt versus Iran, set to face off in Seattle. But the controversy has little to do with the game of soccer itself. The world's Bianca Hilliard is here to tell us more. Bianca, what's going on?
This controversy has to do with the location and theme of the match. It's set to take place on Friday, June 26th at Lumen Field in Seattle. That's the same weekend as Seattle Pride Fest, the city's annual LGBTQ celebration with the parade and lots of different events. The Seattle World Cup Organizing Committee thought, you know, let's combine the Pride events with the soccer tournament and brand the June 26th match as the Pride match. And that does designation was fine. It didn't cause any major reaction until this week when Egypt and Iran were named as the teams who were playing for that Pride match.
Right. Egypt and Iran playing at a soccer game that celebrates the LGBTQ community. And as we know, neither country is known for supporting LGBTQ rights, to say the least.
Exactly. They both severely punish the queer community. In Egypt, homosexuality is not explicitly illegal, but authorities often prosecute people on grounds of debauchery or violating public decency. And in Iran, homosexuality is illegal, and it can carry the death penalty. So now that the World Cup schedule has been set, both Egypt and Iran are starting to speak out and protest this Pride match.
How would they protest? Are they saying their teams won't even show up?
They're not saying that yet, although I can see the situation escalating if things don't change. But in a statement last night, Egypt's National Soccer Federation said they categorically reject this Pride match, adding that the activities directly contradict the cultural, religious, and social values in their region. They also say, you know, FIFA is supposed to be neutral on matters like this, and they've sent a letter to FIFA complaining about these events.
So that's Egypt. What about Iran?
They've sent a complaint as well, according to Iranian state media. And the president of Iran's soccer federation, Mehdi Taj, also went on state TV yesterday to talk about his concerns. He said, quote, both Egypt and we have objected because this is an unreasonable and illogical move that essentially signals support for a particular group. And we must definitely address this point. Marco, he said that Iran Soccer Federation will address the point at a FIFA council meeting in Qatar next week.
So more information possibly coming then. What about FIFA, the World Cup organizers? What are they saying about all of this?
Not much. They haven't released a statement on the matter, and a spokesperson told me today that FIFA is directing all inquiries to the Seattle Organizing Committee, who they say is independent of them. So far, the Seattle Organizing Committee is standing their ground. They told the Associated Press today that they're going ahead with the Pride match, which was planned long before Egypt and Iran were named as the teams playing that day.
Bianca, I know that we're still more than 6 months away from all the World Cup stuff, but has the Seattle Organizing Committee even described what they wanted the Pride match to look like?
No, there's not a lot of details right now, and they didn't reply to my request for comment on that. A spokesperson for the local committee told the AP that the events will be outside the stadium during Pride weekend and throughout the tournament, and their website says they want the events to educate the world, inspire the LGBTQ community, and uplift queer businesses, but no more details than that.
The world's Bianca Hilliard covers sports and the World Cup for the show. Bianca, I know you'll keep watching the story for us. Thanks very much.
My pleasure. Thanks, Marco.
There's a federally funded program that provides free legal counsel to unaccompanied immigrant children seeking asylum in the U.S. Funding for the program was cut earlier this year. The money was later restored through a court order, but attorneys say the lapse was a shock to the system that is still playing out today. From the Fronteras desk in Tucson, KJZZ's Elisa Resnick has the latest installment of our series, Chasing Asylum.
One morning last month, more than two dozen people filed into a crowded immigration courtroom in Tucson. Some squeezed in on the floor. Others stood at the entrance and peered inside. They were there for a proceeding called a master calendar hearing, where several people charged with the same thing appear at once. Before the court that morning, about 20 children. Some were almost legal adults. Others weren't even in their teens yet. Recording anywhere inside federal facilities is prohibited. So what you're hearing is from the outside of a tall building where Tucson's immigration courtrooms are housed. Shiny black windows look out onto a big fountain, and you can hear the sound of the streetcar zooming past. And inside, the federal judge looks out from her raised bench and tells the children that this is the beginning of their removal proceedings. These days, most are facing court alone.
A year ago, that wouldn't have happened because we would be most likely representing those children.
Ana Islas is with the Florence Immigrant and Refugee Rights Project and leads a team in Tucson that represents unaccompanied children in court. Starting in February, the Trump administration began trying to cut the federally funded program that makes that possible. Most of the annual $200 million federal contract split nationwide to do it had been slashed by March. It was restored 2 months later through a court order, but Sam Hasai, an attorney who's part of the legal team to restore the money, says the lapse caused a tailspin.
A lot of these orgs have built their programming, their staff, a lot of processes around serving these unaccompanied children in reliance of this continued federal funding. And so when this all went away, it was a huge shock to the system.
The Florence Project says it laid off 35 of the 200-person staff in July. They're looking for another attorney to join the kids' team now, but haven't been able to hire everyone back because the money is still under threat. The government is appealing the ruling and only dispensing funds in three-month increments. Islas says court prep for many kids is still limited to Know Your Rights presentations.
I feel like in a level they are prepared because they know their rights, but at the same time, no child is prepared to represent themselves in front of the court.
More than 500 children are represented by the Florence Project around Arizona today, but the group is still not taking most new cases. Islas says that's coming as children are staying in custody longer. She says in the past, kids were released quickly to foster care or family members to pursue their cases. But biometric data like fingerprints and even DNA are now part of the reunification process, something undocumented families may be too afraid to do. Another new rule requires sponsors to come to ICE offices in person, where some have been arrested.
You know, they know their parents are nearby, but they may not be able to go see them.
Florence Project attorney Laura Enriquez says there's also just more kids in court now. One by one, they're called to the front, where a government attorney hands them papers about asylum and other protection they could apply for, all in English, a language most don't understand. In one October hearing, a six-year-old from Mexico swung his legs back and forth as the judge told him through a translator that the papers were for him, but they weren't homework. Enriquez again.
Frankly, I don't believe that they understand the gravity of the situation because, I mean, they're just learning about what a judge is.
Enriquez and other attorneys still attend the kids' hearings, but mostly not as their lawyers. And even children who do get out of shelters face an uphill battle in court, especially alone. Last month, a Tucson woman named Lily quieted her toddler as they waited for her 11-year-old half-sister to be called up by the judge. We're not using her full name because she's worried speaking could impact the case.
And I'm here to get my sister. She is a minor, either possibly U.S. citizenship or a green card to keep her here because she is not safe in Mexico.
Lily is a U.S. citizen. Her half-sister and their mother are Mexican citizens. Lily says they came to Arizona last year fleeing an abusive situation. Their mother was arrested and eventually deported.
I'm all she has, honestly, and my kids are so happy to have her, and I want to give her a good life.
She's trying to become her sister's guardian. They told the judge that day that they still hadn't found a lawyer. Every office is on a wait.
It's just been a little mix-up and a circle. I feel like I don't get any help anywhere I go, and I've been trying to do it all by myself.
For The World, I'm Elisa Resnick, Tucson, Arizona.
That was the final story in our series, Chasing Asylum, produced by the Fronteras Desk at KJZZ in Phoenix. And we have one update to share about someone Elisa Resnick reported on earlier this week.
Marhaba, Kamel. Kif halek?
Marhaba, Elisa. Kif halek?
That's a Kamil Maklad calling up Resnick one final time from detention. Maklad is an asylum seeker from Syria who spent more than 2 years locked up in Arizona. He was detained despite winning his legal case for protection in November of last year.
He called Resnick to tell her that he won that case in immigration court and he's getting out.
Cuéntame tu noticias, por favor.
They went back and forth in Spanish and Arabic. Maklad told Resnick that he's finished and would be out of detention soon.
His legal team filed what's called a habeas corpus petition. This brought the case before a federal district court. Attorney Luis Campos said it was their only hope for getting Maklad out.
And this last Friday, the judge ruled in favor of Kamel and basically indicated to the government that the government had to release him, that there was no legal basis for his continued detention.
Campos says he'll help Maklad apply for a work permit and coordinate next steps with ICE.
You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. The U.S. State Department is making a style change. Times New Roman will be the official font for American diplomacy. Previously, Calibri was being used at State. This might seem like an inconsequential choice, but typeface is surprisingly political. Catherine Henschen is a professor of political communication at Northeastern University in Boston. She told us a cable from the State Department called the use of Calibri wasteful and a DEI initiative.
There's really two important takeaways here. The first is that Calibri actually isn't wasteful. It's free. It comes on most computers, so there's no real cost to using it. But we know that people view typefaces through a political lens, especially when they're put in a political context. People think that serif fonts, those are the fonts with little feet, like Times New Roman, are more conservative ideologically than liberal fonts, sans serifs, which don't have the little feet. So Calibri is a liberal sans serif. Times New Roman is a conservative serif font.
What do you make of that? I mean, is that real?
Well, we've seen it in our research on the role of typeface and political graphic design generally. The graphic designers say that serif fonts are indeed viewed as more traditional than sans serif fonts. And this is also true just simply in the history of graphic design. Sans serifs are newer, more modern typefaces.
So that's interesting because reportedly Marco Rubio's predecessor, Antony Blinken, changed the official font of the State Department from Times New Roman to Calibri because apparently it's more compatible with computer screens. Does that make sense to you?
Well, so that is true. There is some empirical work on what kind of typeface is. So a typeface is the letter forms themselves. The font is the word for the file, the computer file that you install on your computer, right? So they do have those technical different meanings. But the sans serif typefaces are easier to read. And in particular, sans serif fonts are easier to read on digital devices.
You know, I think of the many newspapers in France like Le Monde, Figaro, Libération, each with a political slant distinctly. And I wonder if the font brand of a newspaper in this context connotes a particular political association.
It's really funny you say that. I was looking at some of my old research today, and one of the fonts that we tested was this kind of masthead type font. So if you picture the font that the New York Times is written in, right? This very traditional old style font. And though that is exactly, and though that is viewed as generally super conservative, right? It's old. I'm picturing, you know, Gutenberg like printing his Bibles. Though it's viewed as super old and therefore viewed as super conservative, Democrats and independents view it as more conservative than Republicans do. And our assumption is that they are associating it with newspaper mastheads. So we think that there's an additional connotation that's going on there.
So I see that India under Modi uses a font called Noto Sans as the main typeface. It's supposed to kind of emphasize diversity. As an expert in political communication, Catherine, are you seeing this kind of tension over visual text continuing to shift and even fought over, whether here in the U.S. or anywhere around the world?
It's going to always be extremely culturally dependent. And that's what makes some of this hard to generalize around, right? So perfect example. In the United States, red is the Republican Party. In much of the rest of the West, red is the left. And so here in the United States, people respond to a red hat as a symbol of the MAGA movement. That automatic association just won't necessarily exist in other places. So whenever we're understanding these types of graphic design choices, first of all, they are intentional. They're choices. They're meant to convey something. But we need to understand the deep history of the place and the people and its politics to be able to correctly infer what the meaning is.
Well, this is radio, so it's not easy to illustrate all the fonts we've discussed. I'll just say that Fracture, Antiqua, and Noto Sans, none are in my word processing font pack. Catherine Henschen, thanks so much for your time.
You're welcome.
Catherine Henschen is a professor of communications and political science at Northeastern University. The big announcement was on October 10th. Today in Oslo, the Nobel Prize Committee awarded this year's Peace Prize to Venezuela's opposition leader in hiding, Maria Corina Machado. She led a grassroots campaign in Venezuela to topple the authoritarian regime of Nicolas Maduro.
Norway's royal family was at the ceremony, so were some prominent Venezuelan dissidents in exile. But Maria Corina Machado herself was not there in person. The chair of the Norwegian Nobel Committee, Jørgen Vatne Fridnes, said this in his opening remarks.
The Nobel Peace Prize laureate, Maria Corina Machado, has done everything in her power to be able to attend the ceremony here today. A journey in a situation of extreme danger. Although she will not be able to reach this ceremony and today's events, we are profoundly happy to confirm that she is safe and that she will be with us here in Oslo.
Her daughter, Ana Corina Sosa Machado, later took to the podium, holding back tears as she accepted the award on her mother's behalf.
Although she has not been able to be here and take part in this ceremony, I must say that my mother never breaks a promise. And that is why, with all the joy in my heart, I can tell you that in just a few hours, we will be able to embrace her here in Oslo after 16 months living in here.
The Wall Street Journal reports that Machado made a secret departure from her hiding place in Venezuela on Tuesday and that she traveled by boat to the Caribbean island nation of Curaçao. From there, she got on a plane to Oslo, but not in time to make it to the ceremony.
Before reading the speech her mother had written, Ana Corina Sosa Machado acknowledged that her family was not alone in being separated under the Maduro regime.
And as I await that moment to hug her, to kiss her, to embrace her after 2 years, I think of the other daughters and sons who do not get to see their mothers today. This is what drives her, what drives all of us. She wants to live in a free Venezuela, and she will never give up on that purpose.
We have more reporting on Venezuela's opposition movement and the political crackdown it's facing. You can find all of it at theworld.org.
The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio in Boston and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego.
Find more of our reporting on YouTube, and while you're there, be sure to subscribe to our channel. It's called The World News Radio. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for listening. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
The World is supported by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. By the Lumina Foundation, committed to a fair, universal system for learning beyond high school that offers every American the chance for a better life. LuminaFoundation.org. And by FJC, a foundation of philanthropic funds serving the nonprofit sector with donor-advised funds, fiscal sponsorship, bridge lending, and more. FJC.org. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. More information at theworld.org.